Today, my guest is Dr. Rick Hansen. Rick is a neuropsychologist and the author of several best-selling books, including Hardwiring Happiness, The New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence, and also the best-selling Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. And Rick has a really remarkable way of feeding these concepts together so that he includes mindfulness, shows how it shifts your attention, shows how that in turn shifts your neurology, and that in turn actually changes the way your brain processes information and the structure of your neural network over time. And more than anyone else, I think, he draws these lines so clearly, so explicitly, and in a way that most people can understand. Rick, it is such a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, Dawson, you are so gracious, and you walk your talk. Just talking with you, I feel calmer and happier.
Well, savor that moment.
Because all right, well, I'll let it sink in. That's what my book's about, letting it sink in.
And, you know, one of the phrases from your previous book that I've quoted to audiences all over the world is that you said our brains are like Velcro for negative experiences and like Teflon for positive experiences. So just go ahead and talk about the evolutionary biology of that. And before we get into what you're doing with your new book, that basic concept that we cling mentally to the unpleasant, the negative. I mean, this is the bane of spiritual seekers everywhere. This is the bane of people who want to grow and shift their lives or transform in some way, that our brains are literally hardwired to cling to those negative experiences. So when you try and change or shift your behavior, it is so incredibly hard. And you explained in that earlier book why that's so.
Well, thanks for the setup there. Yes, the brain has what scientists call a negativity bias, or as you've quoted me, as I put it, it's like Velcro for the bad, but Teflon for the good. And people understandably want to know, why did it get this way? And first, let me give you some examples of the negativity bias. One is very familiar, I'm sure, to everybody. Let's say you're in a relationship with someone, you work with them, you live with them, maybe you sleep with them, and 10 things happen in a day. 5 are positive with this person, 4 are neutral with this person, and 1 is negative with this person. Which is the one you tend to think about when you're falling asleep, right?
Yeah.
It's the negative one. And as much research shows, negative information about somebody is more memorable than positive information. We tend to work harder to avoid a loss than to get an equivalent gain. We're more upset about losing something we've got than we are happy about getting something new, right? Research on couples, long-term good couples, shows that they need at least a 5-to-1 ratio of positive to negative interactions. That's a cautionary tale. In effect, 1 negative interaction is as powerful as 5 positive ones. So why did we get this way? It's because as our ancestors evolved over the 600 million years of the evolution of the nervous system, in a larger context, as you know, of 3.5 billion years of the evolution of life, it's important to appreciate what a long, strange trip it has been, to quote the Grateful Dead, what a long, strange trip it's been. Anyway, as our ancestors evolved, they needed to get carrots, you know, food, mating opportunities, shelter, and so forth, and they needed to avoid sticks, predators, natural hazards, aggression inside their band or between bands. There was
right,
a lot of aggression between primate bands and early human bands. So the difference, though, between a carrot and a stick, a reward and a penalty, is that if you fail to get a carrot today, you'll have a chance at a carrot tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid that stick today, whap, no more carrots forever. So in effect, once burned, twice shy. So to bottom line it, we've got a brain that's really good at learning from the bad, but it's bad at learning from the good, even though, unfortunately, good experiences, positive experiences, are the primary way to build up the inner strengths and spiritual capabilities and everyday resilience, let alone a positive mood or love in your heart that we all want to deal with life and be happy, cope with difficulties, and have something inside ourselves to give to others.
So we now find ourselves in this environment with no objective threats. Those negative, those hostile bands aren't around anymore, at least in the overt sense of physical threat. And yet, with these brains wired that way, we are still predisposed to function in that manner.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the point here is it's important to see real threats. Absolutely true. But most people, me included, have a tendency to worry more than is actually rational, or feel more frustrated than we really need to, or feel more isolated and lonely than is actually supported by the truth of things. It's really quite poignant. You know, it's we tend to suffer more than we need to. And in particular, if you think of life as an opportunity for learning, the question then becomes, how do we actually help ourselves learn from our experiences when we've got a brain that's not very good at learning from positive experiences? And that's what my book's about. It's about basically how do you pop open the bottleneck to get the good stuff inside. That's the basis of mindfulness, compassion, spiritual insights, as well as just everyday strength inside yourself.
And so you have this very simple seeming but powerful prescription for how to start to rewire your neural network to pay attention to those things. What does it recommend?
Oh, I think the number one thing is to appreciate the power of everyday positive experiences by helping them sink into your brain 10, 20 seconds at a time. In other words, there's a saying in Tibet, if you take care of the minutes, the years will take care of themselves. I think, what's the most important minute in your life? It's the next one, minute after minute after minute. So when you're having an everyday positive experience, you know, you finished something, you finished an email or a load of laundry, or you're experiencing the pleasure in a cup of tea or conversation with a friend, or you're listening to Dawson Church and getting inspired and feeling elevated, whatever it might be, when you're having that positive experience, don't just assume that it's sinking into you. Your brain is not very good at that. What you need to do is bring some mindful attention to it, just to stay with it 10 or 20 or more seconds in a row. This goes to the methods in my book. I use the acronym HEAL. Once you have the positive experience, E for enrich it, H for have it, E for enrich it, and then A for absorb. Prime your memory systems by intending and sensing that this positive experience is sinking into you. And then optional, as a bonus, if it's appropriate, you could link, L for link, the positive experience you're having to some negative material. So the positive material goes into the negative, gradually soothing and even replacing it. So have a positive experience, enrich it, absorb it, and if you want, link it to something negative, giving you that little acronym, HEAL.
Ah, wonderful. That's a very simple thing to remember and a very powerful practice. And talk about how this affects the brain. You refer to the phrase experience-dependent neuroplasticity in your book. And that's a powerful concept which shows how those mental exercises actually over time literally shift the structure of the brain, and you actually rewire your brain as you exercise these options to focus on those positive experiences. So go ahead and explain experience-dependent neuroplasticity to us and how over time this does have that effect on the actual circuits in your brain's biology.
That's exactly right. You know, the brain is constantly changing its structure. It's the organ that learns. I can just feel myself getting excited talking about this because it's so remarkable and hopeful. Although, on the other hand, there's a cautionary tale here because we have a brain that learns and changes its structure, therefore, all too easily from negative experiences, including just ordinary negative experiences like getting irritated or worried or feeling inadequate or feeling blue. Anyway, the good news is that through the power of, as you say, experience-dependent neuroplasticity, what we think and what we feel and how we relate to what we think and feel is gradually and continually changing the structure of our brain. For me, the takeaway point here is the brain changing for better or worse? And who's doing the changing, right? Is it the media outside us or other people bumping into us in various ways, or the legacy inside our mind and therefore inside our brain of our personal history, even growing up as a child, the ghosts inside your mind? Is that what's changing your brain? Or is it you who is changing your brain by deliberately looking for legitimate, authentic opportunities to have a useful, positive experience? And then when you're having one, typically a mild one, you know, just in the flow of everyday life, when you're having that useful experience, are you helping it sink into you so it's not wasted?
And you talk about the importance as well of being deliberate about this, being, actually setting this up as not just a good intention, but as a lifestyle practice. And that it's that repetition over time that starts to shift you. Just two questions about time here that strike me. What's the magic? How did you come to that number of 10 to 20 seconds? And how long does it take for these neural circuits to start to change?
Oh, that's great. So it's interesting. There's a lot of research about learning, including emotional learning. And learning means changing the structure of the brain. Now, I want to create a bit of a frame here. So far, we've been speaking inside what scientists or others might call the natural frame, the naturalist frame. In other words, thinking about mind as a natural process, thoughts and feelings as naturally occurring, rather than in a supernatural or even transcendental frame. I personally think, as I suspect you do as well, that there really is something outside the natural frame that is meaningful and exists, something transcendental, perhaps something supernatural as well. But so far, we're really talking about very, very natural ways that our thoughts and our feelings can change our brain structure. So that's part one. Part two, in terms of learning and changing the brain, the research on learning, including emotional learning and even spiritual learning, because at this point they're doing really interesting studies on monks, Buddhist monks, TM meditators, Christian nuns, long-term, short-term practitioners, even people simply taking an 8-week meditation course. And the findings are really quite remarkable. So research on learning shows that there are 5 major factors that make a difference in the encoding of a passing mental state into lasting neural structure. There's this distinction in psychology between states and traits. That's an easy way to remember it, states and traits. States are changing, fleeting, impermanent. Traits, on the other hand, are more enduring. We can have a thought or a feeling that's a mental state. The question is, are we taking the extra 10 or 20 or more seconds to help that state become a trait? So learning research shows that these 5 factors include duration, the longer the better. Second, intensity, feeling something really fully rather than superficially. Third, quote unquote, multimodality, the idea that we register, we're having an experience that's very rich emotionally and as a sensory experience in the body. We might even also be enacting it in some way, even a subtle one, such as sitting up a little straighter to help ourselves feel more determined or strong, or letting an expression of caring and concern move into our face to deepen an experience of compassion or kindness for others. That's the third factor, multimodality. The fourth factor is novelty. That's very established in research. The more that something is fresh or new, the more likely it is that the brain will turn it into lasting structure, because the brain is a big novelty detector. It's always looking for what's new. And the last factor is personal relevance, sometimes called salience. Why does this matter? Why should I care about this? Because the brain is going to change based on what we care about. So those 5 factors, duration, intensity, multimodality, novelty, and personal relevance, any one of them will heighten the degree to which a positive mental state is getting transformed into a positive neural trait. The general idea is mo beta. You know, that's easy to remember. Two words, mo beta. More is better. You know, deep down in the bowels of the brain, down in the basement, as it were, it's a pretty mechanistic process. Just more better. You know the saying in neuroscience, neurons that fire together, wire together. You're just trying to get as many neurons firing together as long as possible and as intensely as possible. Another way to think about this is that research on learning shows that it's a two-stage process. There are short-term memory buffers, and then there is long-term storage. Negative experiences transfer immediately through essentially dedicated superhighways of information into long-term storage. They move right out of those short-term buffers, negative experiences, like feeling hurt or physical pain or being worried about something. That transfers right away to long-term storage. But positive experiences have standard memory systems. And in standard memory systems, information, including the information that constitutes a positive emotional experience, that has to be held in short-term buffers and renewed there, typically for at least several seconds, if not 5 or 10 or 20 seconds in a row. I mean, we've all had the experience probably of trying to remember a phone number or a license plate, or more in an emotional way, to really let something good sink in, maybe a spiritual insight or a sweet time with a friend or the day our child was born. You know, we want to really help it go in. And so we recognize that we need to savor it. We need to stay with it 5, 10, or 20 seconds in a row for it to transfer from short-term memory buffers to long-term storage. So that's the how to do it. And it also points to the reality that if we just are having a positive experience, but we don't take the time to help it sink in, we don't take that kind of threshold, we don't get past that threshold of at least 5 or 10 seconds or so to help it sink in, then unfortunately, that positive experience, including spiritual experiences or important personal growth experiences, is largely, if not entirely, wasted on the brain. And this is the fundamental weakness in psychotherapy. I'm a longtime therapist, and in meditation teaching. You know, I've done a lot of that as well. Plus everyday coaching, yoga teachers, you know, corporate stress management courses, character education for children, addiction and recovery work, and so forth. We're very good at activating positive mental states in people. But historically, we've been very bad at teaching people how to install those activated mental states into lasting neural structure. And that's where the opportunity is, because it's very humbling, as I've experienced many times, to appreciate how often the hard-won positive mental states we have ourselves, or we're helping others to have, frankly, have no lasting value. They're pleasant in the moment, but because they're not changing the brain, they don't have any kind of enduring value. And so our opportunity to finish up here is to deliberately help these positive experiences last based on some simple understanding of the way the brain works, so that they sink into us and are not wasted.
Yeah, and everyone who's been in recovery or has been in psychotherapy or has done a coaching class knows that you'll have these wonderful intentions when you leave the class, when you finish up, but that as soon as you're exposed to your regular cues and your real-life stresses, you go revert right back to your old behavior. So to find ways of anchoring those positive learnings over and over and over again till they become really entrenched in that neural network is the key. And I guess that's why, for example, in Buddhism, daily or even twice daily meditation is recommended so that one can do that.
That's right. I mean, it goes back to mo beta, you know, or if I could get four words to sum it up instead of just two, have it, enjoy it. Have it is the activation phase. That's important. You've got to light the fire. But if you want to have any kind of enduring value, then you need to enjoy it. You know, you need to add logs to the fire, as it were, in my metaphor here. Keep it going, you know, duration, intensity, etc. And also absorb it. You know, let the warmth of the fire, this positive experience, in other words, really sink into you.
And then I think your brain starts to become habituated to that. I know one of the things I've done some research on is cortisol levels. And the lab I use to measure cortisol says that it takes about 5 months to affect your cortisol levels. So once you get into, say, a higher stress environment, after about 5 months, you'll see your cortisol level, your set point will have changed and will have risen. But if you change your lifestyle and are less stressed, then that doesn't show up right away in your cortisol patterns. It can actually take 5 months for that to show up. And so over time, if you persist, though, your set point changes and you become literally cortisol intolerant at those higher stress levels. So it's interesting that that short-term things don't affect us, but we have all these reinforcing systems, both hormonal, neurotransmitters, our neural network, and so on. All of these things are reinforcing systems in the body. And if we stick with them, they do start to change eventually. And so you talk about in the book about how this gradually installs positive behaviors, feelings, beliefs into the brain. And it is a gradual process, and you have to stick with it for that effect to really take hold in your neural network and in your hormonal and neurotransmitter systems.
That is interesting. I think both things are true. In other words, well, three things are okay, kind of succinctly, if I can, you know, and interrupt me if I'm not succinct. Let's see. First, the more episodes of taking in the good, in other words, of helping good life learning stick to us and sink in, the better, right? Because just to repeat a point I made in the very beginning quite quickly, the primary source of happiness inside ourselves or other inner strengths such as determination, kindness, mindfulness, concentration power, etc. The primary source of these inner strengths are positive experiences. So the more episodes that we have, the better. Second point, inside any single episode, the longer you experience it, the more intensely you experience it. In other words, the more you get those neurons firing together than they wire together, the better. I've seen photographs, because they're in scientific journals, of how rapidly new synapses begin to form. Within 10 minutes, if not less, new structures start to build in the brain, linking neurons together that have been firing together. So it can be really quite rapid in terms of the change. And again, we routinely have experiences where we learn immediately about something. That kind of learning, whether it's just, you know, learning the name of a new friend, let's say, if we're learning, that's making an immediate change. Also, even if it takes, even if it's not structural change, there can be functional change in the brain when there's new emotional learning. So I'm a little skeptical of the 5 month claim. I think that might be true for some people. But on the other hand, you know, if you are fairly quickly and fundamentally shifting your sense of internal stress, that's going to fairly quickly reduce cortisol releases in your body. And that's also going to tend to shift cortisol, you know, even resting state cortisol. So, I guess my point is, I think there's a lot of individual variation here. And I suspect that many of the people who do... the example, Dawson, that you gave a little earlier, I think a lot of those people are activating useful mental states, but they're not staying with them for the 10, 20, 30 seconds it takes to wire them into their brain.
Yes. And that is what, of course, you say is that simple but powerful prescription that if we just give ourselves that added boost, if we give ourselves that added added felt sense of this for a little while, that starts to really shift the whole way these experiences are engraved in our neural network. That's really interesting, and the speed with which this happens is really astonishing. I've seen those videos, literally watching synaptic connections start to form before your very eyes. It's astonishing to think that we're doing this with every thought, every feeling, every experience, because the old model of the brain was very different. And you know, when I'm sure when you were in graduate school or when I was, there was no concept this was possible. What was that old model, that old picture of the brain before we began to have those kinds of discoveries?
Right. There is always, I think, an understanding that the brain had to change its structure for learning to occur. In other words, something had to change. Right? What was that change? But in that old model, the notion of these changes was that they were fairly superficial. And it was posited somehow that something had to change, but the basic underlying morphology, the structure of the brain, the core networks of the brain would not change. But as you point out, in the last 10 years, what's been quite remarkable is the new evidence, a lot given to us through new scanning technologies like fMRIs or other forms of scanning the brain that have revealed that you know, these changes can really happen very, very rapidly and through a variety of robust mechanisms. For example, people who routinely practice relaxation have improved expression of the genes that downregulate, that calm down the stress response. The genes themselves don't change, but through epigenetic processes, their expression changes. I just find that remarkable, the idea that, you know, thinking about fluffy white clouds or whatever for 10 minutes a day can actually somehow lead to a cascade of neurochemical effects that reach into the nucleus of these tiny little neurons, right? 100 billion neurons amidst another trillion cells inside the skull, and then go into the nucleus down into a long molecule, DNA, and reach into and connect with a strip of atoms inside that twisted up molecule of DNA, the strip of atoms being the gene. You know, I just think that's amazing and highly motivating, right? Because when you know
yes.
that you can make those changes, you know, one of the takeaways for me, Dawson, I've become a lot more careful about what I indulge in the back of my mind. You know, that kind of nattering voice in the back of the head that's grumbling about life or resentful about other people or beating you up, you know, the self-criticism. Neurons that fire together wire together. And that nagging voice in the back of the head is continually changing us. And that's why I think, you know, I go into the book in a lot of ways, how important it is to, over time, build up kinder voices inside you, you know, the ones that are, they're reasonable, they're not over complimenting you, but they're encouraging, they put things in perspective for you, and they can speak up against that internalized critic that kind of tends to pound on people.
Yes, and there are a lot of techniques you can use to do that. One of my favorites comes from Jack Canfield, and Jack says that have a preformed, premeditated, positive piece of self-talk you will use as a substitute for your negative self-talk, which you determine at the beginning of each day. So rather than seeing the negative self-talk happening in that back of your mind and then trying to come up with some positive self-talk, define a phrase, just could be a simple phrase like, I love and accept myself, that you will then revert to every single time you hear yourself having that negative natter at the back of your mind. And so it's your default setting. You gradually start to shift to that default setting. I know when I've had personal difficulties with people in my life, I have practiced, I'll think about the person's name or I'll see their face of somebody that I'm in a conflict with, and I'll use that face or that name as a cue to think positive thought about them or about myself. And so you start to re-tag that image of this person's face or name you're in conflict with, it becomes a stimulus, and the response is that this you have this positive thought, this positive image, this positive piece of self-talk. So you can actually use even the negative experiences in your life to as cues, as deliberate behavioral cues, to shift into those positive kinds of cognitions. And so it's really powerful to start to use these simple techniques, like having one positive affirmative statement you use as a substitute for all the bad stuff that goes on there. Because, you know, as you know, from being a therapist, the kinds of self-talk, the kinds of, and I'll go so far as to call it self-hatred, Rick, that many people have just just yammering away in their minds day in, day out. When they go into therapy and they tell you what's really happening with their self-talk, you feel such compassion for the average person. They are so filled with this stuff, even though they may, on the surface, they may be very functional. Often back down deep there in their consciousness, they are having all these incredibly negative messages echoing around every day. So whatever you can do to help people shift that is wonderful.
I agree, and you've summed it up really well there. You know, one of the things that has become an increasing focus for me and is this idea of antidote experiences.
Yes.
In other words, imagine a sequence of four questions. I keep coming back to these four questions again and again, and I think they're helpful for individuals to ask themselves and also to offer to others. So the first question is, what's the issue? Whatever it might be, you know, the situation, or perhaps it's a recurrent feeling inside, like
yes.
a blue mood. Okay. Second, what if it were more present in my mind, what would really help? In other words, if I'm feeling, let's say, anxious, if I had more of a sense of strength or protection or relaxation or safety, or noticing that I'm actually in this moment all right, that would help with my anxiety. Or alternately, if I felt frustrated or disappointed, or I'd had some failures recently, it would help me to have more experiences of, or more gratitude inside, or more gladness inside, or more sense of accomplishment. Or if I felt lonely or inadequate or disdained by others, it would help to have more sense inside of being included, appreciated, even loved. So you have this idea then of, what is the targeted resource that would help your particular issue, or, you know, and what would be high impact if you had it more inside yourself? That's the second question. The third question is then follows, how could I have more experiences of that inner strength? Because neurons that fire together wire together. If I can just get some experience of that resource inside or some related factors, then going to the fourth question, how can I help this sink in? How can I take this into myself? So one of the interesting things I've done, and you know, you can see it in the book, it's easy. There's a table of issues, and then what's kind of a natural antidote that's targeted at that particular issue. So if you know what the issue is that you're working on these days, that takes you quickly to what would be the resource, the inner strength inside that could make a difference, and how can I experience it more? Then life becomes this fantastic opportunity. And I've used this method myself. I think it's one of the top five personal growth, even spiritual practice methods to look for the positive experience and legitimate opportunities for the positive experience that is the natural antidote to or medicine for, right? Or resource for some issue you're dealing with, ranging from old pain to a current challenge to some way you're trying to help yourself grow. And then if you can have that experience of that resource one or two or three or even more times a day, you can really have a big impact on yourself. And even if you want, in the fourth step, you know, of the HEAL acronym, taking the good, linking, you can get a sense that this key resource experience, this, you know, soul medicine to play with, you know, your own show, this soul food, can actually connect with, this positive material can connect with and go into these places inside that have felt wounded or neglected, or even very young places inside yourself can finally receive, you know, what they've always longed for.
Yeah. And there are two threads I'd like to pick up what you just said. You mentioned there are these personal growth practices that can start to fill in those deficits, as you describe so beautifully there. And go ahead and give us a few others that either you've used yourself or you advocate in the books.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. Well, for me personally, I'll share a personal story here that's relevant. You know, I grew up in a loving family, and I was very young going through school. I skipped a grade, I have a late birthday, and consequently, I had many experiences with other kids in school of feeling put down or left out. So long story short, nothing horrible happened to me, and what happened to me was fairly small compared to, unfortunately, what happens to other people. But it still had an impact. You know, causes have effects, and I ended up with what I called a hole in my heart.
Yes.
Then I realized, waha, if I actually took the opportunity, and I started stumbling on this in college, if I took the opportunity to have an ordinary experience of feeling included, seen, even liked, etc., that I could take it into myself. You know, if a girl smiled at me in the elevator or some guys on my floor said, let's go get pizza, that actually would make a difference for me. I have a model in the book that relates to a fairly widely used framework at this point, based on the notion of the triune brain, that in our stages of evolution from reptile to mammal to human, we developed better and better ways to meet our three needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection through broad systems in the brain that help us avoid harms in terms of our safety needs, help us approach rewards in terms of our satisfaction needs, and help us attach to others in terms of our needs for connection. And an easy way to remember that is that inside each one of us is a little lizard, a little mouse, and a little monkey. And what life really boils down to in a lot of ways is pet the lizard, feed the mouse, and hug the monkey. So that's the goofy. I admit it. It's silly, goofy, but I swear I feel like I've got that zoo inside my own head. So that's a way to think about it. And then you can go to, what's your key need right now, right? What's the primary issue in your life these days? And is it more in the safety system, the metaphorically speaking, to grossly simplify, you know, the lizard brain, if you will, or are your needs, you know, more in the territory of the satisfaction system? They're more, your needs are more related to disappointment or frustration or loss or failure. The, if you will, the mouse part of the brain, the mammalian reward-seeking part of the brain. Or are your needs, as mine were, are they more centered in the attaching system of the brain in terms of your needs for connection, the more recent primate and human part of the brain? Needs like loneliness or feeling abandoned or feeling not seen or put down, or looking for love in all the wrong places, or feeling not valued by others, feeling ashamed or inadequate inside. So that's a way to think about it too. That's what I would say about that. And then when you know what that is, you can look for experiences that are natural resources. They don't have to be a perfect fit, but let me give you a quick example here. Suppose that you feel worried about something. You know, you're worried about someone, you know, about an illness you've got, or maybe you had some bad news from a doctor and you're grappling with that. You're worried about it. And then would gratitude practice help that much? Probably not, right? Or even if somebody paid you a compliment and said how good your hair looked today, or, you know, how handsome you are or something, that'd be nice. But it wouldn't address your need. You know, it doesn't go down to speak to the fundamental issue that you have. And that's the problem. And so for me, what's useful is for a person to recognize what are your personal needs, and then how can you get those needs met and take it in.
So you tailor your what you're looking to take in based upon the kind of need you have.
Yeah. And if you give me an example, I can speak to it even further. And in the book, I go through tons and tons of examples about this.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the ones that's been striking to me lately is I have been having a dialogue with some of my colleagues about what constitutes a traumatic experience. And
what kind of experience?
A traumatic experience.
Traumatic, got it.
And obviously being beaten up at school would be, you know, rape, incest, assault, all of those things, clearly they're life or self-threatening. But what seemingly innocuous experiences that people who had pretty good childhoods could be perceived as trauma. And one of the bits of research we've been debating in that way is the set of experiments called the still face experiments,
which
mothers are asked not to respond to their baby's cues with facial expressions. So they simply, in fact, works for fathers as well. The father simply sits there with the infant, or the mother sits there with the infant and has a blank face while the infant, maybe 6 or 8 months old, is in front of them. And the infant starts to try really hard to change that still face. It really begins to usually wave its arms around, make noises. But then if it still gets no emotional connection, cue from its parent, it then starts to go into a lot of distress, more and more and more distress, and eventually actually it dysregulates the whole autonomic nervous system. It's astonishing how pervasive the effect even of a lack of attention is in infants. So this has been really, I began on the side of the debate that it takes a lot to traumatize us. But I have to say, I've been persuaded more and more that even the withdrawal of those cues of attachment can produce pretty major distress in the developing brain.
That's exactly right. And just my own background is rooted in child development, which really speaks to the importance and primacy of that word again, learning. And I've seen clips of that sort of thing, and the children just collapse. They break down in distress, including otherwise perfectly healthy, normal children. So a couple points here. One is to appreciate that trauma has to do in a lot of ways with the fit between the individual and what's happening. And for one, people vary in their temperamental robustness, their constitutional sensitivity or robustness. Some kids are just more sensitive than others. And then life happens, which can sensitize us further, or it can take a robust child and make that child very sensitive. So I think sometimes it's important to not dismiss what has happened to us, because, you know, perhaps other people had similar experiences and they seem to be doing fine. But the real thing is, what's the impact on us, yes, given our own personal temperament? Exactly.
An experience might seem innocuous to one person, but for a person of a different temperament might be severely traumatic.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We don't know the history of other people. And I think that has helped me to be less judgmental about people, because we don't know what they've been through. We don't know how this landed on them in particular. The second key point, I think, is that a lot of micro traumas can add up to a macro trauma. In other words, lots of little bad things can gradually add up to make a really big difference in people. And I've known people who clearly have been traumatized. I mean, they have the symptoms and the picture of complex PTSD, and yet there's no major smoking gun in their personal history, no single devastating event, but a lot of things added up. That, yes, then goes for me to something very hopeful, though, which is that if lots of little bad things added up to take us to a bad place, lots of little good things can add up to take us to a better one. And that's where I think the opportunity is there for us. And I think I would describe myself as landing in college at 16 when I started, because it goes back to that skipping a grade. I was messed up. I was messed up. You know, I was a really neurotic, unhappy, socially deeply awkward, deeply inhibited, repressed, hypersensitive person. And nothing horrible had ever happened to me. But then I did a lot of work adding up, you know, a few seconds here, a few seconds there, a few times every day. That then, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, have really added up to some serious changes in me.
Well, Rick, I'm glad I know you now rather than then. Because, you know, I just want to tell you, when I hear you speak, when I met you at conferences, yeah, you have such a wonderful, warm manner, and you really take the whole room and inspire them and make them feel elevated and just really take them to a beautiful place by your presence, your manner, and your presentation. So
Thank you.
Have a beautiful way of offering that to people. Now, we only have a few minutes left, but I want to just really pick up on one other thread we didn't have a chance to cover. When you mentioned the whole concept of having an idea, a thought, a practice dwelling on that positive experience for a few moments longer. And then that's sending neurological signals, hormonal signals to your cells. And then that strand of DNA unwrapping and making a different protein than it would have otherwise done. One of the amazing things here is that we're literally talking here about things like meditation, mindfulness, tapping, any somatic experiencing, all of these wonderful new techniques. We're talking about these actually being epigenetic interventions. I mean, it's the same way as if you popped a pill to try and have some kind of shift in your neural network or in your neurobiology. So you're taking that pill, hoping to have this effect. But we're saying now that some of these new kinds of or newly popular techniques literally are epigenetic interventions in the same way as sort of drugs or other kinds of medicines are.
You're exactly right. It is really true. And one of the just two findings that I suspect you know about is that, first of all, the bad news here is that, well, actually, it's good news as well, is that there's new research that shows that some epigenetic effects, in other words, changes of gene expression, not just the genes, not the genes themselves, based on experience, in other words, events and their impact on us, that these epigenetic changes can be passed down through the generations independent of environmental or cultural pathways of transmitting effects down through the generations. In other words, to kind of put it concretely, the grandchild, the adopted, I'm going to put it, if you imagine a very stressed out mother having a baby that she puts up for adoption, and then that baby having a very normal life, and then that baby who's now a woman having a child put up for adoption. So we're separating out in our thought experiment here the impact of the psychology of the grandmother. That and you can do this more carefully in controlled animal research. That grandchild of the stressed out grandmother will be more vulnerable to stress, will be less resilient through epigenetic changes that are handed down the lineage. That's really quite extraordinary, and this is research in just the last few years. Also, a separate finding from a recent long-term meditation retreat, you may know about this as well, Dawson, I bet you do. Telomeres, or sometimes pronounced telomeres, are these little strips of atoms at the ends of the DNA molecule that get shorter and shorter as we age, and the DNA molecules replicate as cells divide. As we age, the shortening of the telomeres or telomeres is associated with diseases linked to aging. Okay.
Yes.
At the end of a 3-month meditation retreat, people who were on the retreat compared to people who were randomly assigned to a wait list who also had a long-term meditation history. So, you know, what kind of person is going to want to meditate for 3 months, right? This fairly developed group of people, nonetheless, the people who did intensive practice preserved the length of their telomeres compared to those who did not do the 3-month meditation retreat. Isn't that, again, remarkable? And it suggests another way in which regular practice of some kind or another, whatever that is, including people I know who meditate while walking their dog in the morning in the, you know, in a little path by their in the woods near their home. You know, whatever it is we do in our practice, one real possibility is that we're actually having the epigenetic, we're cultivating epigenetic factors that can lead to long-term health and even greater longevity.
You know, it's interesting to me how hard science is now validating these soft sciences. So my colleagues who were molecular biologists or physicists always sort of looked askance at psychology and meditation and all of these sort of soft sciences, the social sciences, the psychological sciences. And yet now we're using the hard sciences, with things like telomere length measurement, with things like hormonal measurement, with things like neurological shifts, MRI scans, and so on. We're using hard science to validate that these soft sciences can be having profound effects on our lives and our biology. And Rick, we need to wrap it up here. I'm sorry we're out of time, but I'll be also providing a written little workbook to go along with the interview. In that, we'll mention those four items that go along with that wonderful acronym of yours, HEAL. We'll also include the five factors that help you turn positive mental states into positive neural traits. So we'll go ahead and include a bunch of this in the written material as well. I want to thank you so much for yet another powerful, inspiring, heartful, magnificent interview. Thank you ever so much.
Oh, thank you, Dawson. And people are it's very good for people. It's very fortunate that they have you doing what you do. I really mean that sincerely. You're the top.
It takes one to know one. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.